as well. We will now proceed to case number 4, please. Cohen Development versus JMJ Properties.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Steve Corey. I represent the plaintiff appellant in this action, Cohen Development Company. I certainly won't take the Court's time to recite the facts that are laid out pretty extensively in our brief. I only want to mention, by way of context, in 1995, the plaintiff optioned 136 acres of property in Minnesota for an outlet mall. 10 months later, he contracted with the defendant, who agreed that simultaneously with the purchase of the 136 acres by the plaintiff of the property, the defendant would then take 60 of those acres. The original purchase price was $700,000. The defendant agreed to take 60 of those acres for $1 million. After a series of extensions and negotiations, etc., 2 years later, the original seller of the property sold 100 acres to the defendant. There were two clear winners in that. The defendant received 100 acres instead of the 60 for a price less than what he was going to pay, approximately $150,000. The original sellers sold less than what they were going to sell for a price $200,000 in excess of what Cohen was to pay. And then there was one loser in the deal. Cohen got nothing out of the deal.
Mr. Corey?
Yes.
I think what we need to talk about, and I know you don't have too much time, is the language of Exhibit 36.
Exhibit 36 being?
That's that letter that starts out, I received your letter last week.
The May letter?
It's the April letter.
Okay, yes.
It is true we've had numerous discussions concerning the Albertville property. However, I do not recall ever reaching any firm agreements. And then he goes on to say, well, I don't have to read it to you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I believe our best course of action.
Your Honor, we believe that the district court erred in not focusing on the April and May exchange of letters.
That we missed the April exchange.
That is the
yes.
We believe that formed a contract, that Morris sent a letter in April and said, if you let me do the deal, we'll all end up with what we said we would end up with. Cohen followed that with a letter in May that said, okay, we accept that. The trial court, and what we argued extensively at the district court level, as did the defendant, said, even if that constituted a contract, the district court never said it did or it didn't. It never did that analysis, and we believe that's where it erred. It said even if that constituted the contract, what they did subsequently by way of negotiation eliminated whether that's a contract or not.
But
well, then,
I'm sorry. If we go on to Exhibit 37, the response to Exhibit 36, Mr. Cohen states, I ask that you provide a red line or summary of what we can later incorporate into a more formal written agreement.
Correct.
What after 36 and 37 would show conclusively that the parties had come to a meeting of the mind?
There was a statement that in a follow-up conversation that the parties had where Cohen indicated, well, we basically have an agreement, do we not? And Morris said yes. And that's
not in writing, is it?
No.
But if these parties continued to negotiate, isn't it quite evident that they didn't have a contract? Or why would they have continued?
Your Honor,
you certainly can't find it by conversation under the Illinois law.
I think
that's the
critical issue in this case. The Dawson case, which we think is the controlling case, Dawson versus GM, which was decided by this court in 92, says that you can have a letter agreement, which we believe this was, and you can continue to negotiate so you can enter into a 30-page more formal agreement later. In the Dawson case, that's what happened. They never finalized that agreement. And yet the Dawson case says you had an agreement based on the letter agreement that was...
Is there any place in the contract that they talk about the $225,000 payment as a material term?
In the,
as being agreed upon?
In the exchange of letters?
In a contract. Is there any, in the absence of a... of the $225,000 payment, that it was a material term of the contract?
We believe that that term is incorporated by reason of the letter saying you will have your original deal and I will have mine. And it references back the earlier agreement that they entered into in October of 95.
Orally?
No. There was a written agreement in October of 95 between the parties that expired.
Right. So there is no contract then.
Well, except
once it's expired, there's no contract.
Correct, except right. That the April letter references that agreement and says you will have your deal, what we originally agreed to. But I will say this, Your Honor, subsequently in one of the drafts that everybody says there must not be an agreement here because this subsequent draft was not signed, Mr. Morse acknowledges it's his draft in the whereas sections in the recitals, the existing agreement between the parties. And yet, we are saying that the contract was formed under Dawson back in May and April, April and May. The trial court says, doesn't address whether that's a contract or not under Dawson, doesn't even cite Dawson. The trial judge says, even if you had an agreement, the subsequent negotiations eliminate that agreement and you didn't finalize under the subsequent negotiations. We are saying...
Cohen agreed to the new terms of the deal that eliminated the $225,000 payment?
Cohen sent back a letter that says, we agree to this, we'll waive the $225,000, you don't have an easement at it.
And where are we now? First you said we...
Well, we've always maintained that the May, April and May letters is the agreement. The fact that subsequent negotiations took place under Dawson doesn't mean...
But here you've got the first it is a material part. Here he's agreed to not have it any longer.
Well,
that would be eliminated.
I'm sure, Your Honor, that the defendant would like to have that cake and eat it too, meaning he's agreed that he doesn't get the $225,000, but he doesn't get the rest of the benefit of the bargain because he's going to step up here and say those subsequent negotiations didn't result in a contract. All we're saying is this: the analysis that has to occur on the April and May has to be done in light of Dawson, and that analysis has never occurred. And that's what we're asking, not the question, the fact, the finding of fact, but the legal analysis. The Dawson case either
you're
has
into
to be
your rebuttal speech. Time, that's all right. But you can keep it up. Go ahead.
Well,
it's your turn.
Your Honor, I'm probably violating a cardinal rule of argument. I'm going to waive my rebuttal and simply say that neither the trial judge or the defendant has ever addressed the Dawson case, which we think is the controlling case in this case. What they will address is that... Cohen misled everybody, that Cohen wasn't smart enough to outfox the guy who he was doing the deal with, that Cohen's a rich kid. And we would rather have the argument focus on does Dawson apply or not. And if it's distinguished in some fashion, fine. But we think legally it fits very nicely into this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kevin Even appearing on behalf of JMJ Properties.
Why don't you just go right into Dawson for us?
Well, Your Honor, if I could put this into context, this is a case that I think is contract by gotcha, where the agreement that these parties had back in the fall of 1996 expired, and the judge is correct in saying that that contract is over with. We come along to April of 1997, and we see a letter, an April 3rd letter, from Cohen Development that says, hey, you know, we've got an agreement here, and why don't you provide us with a formal document? And the letter comes back, and the court correctly cited it, the April 8th letter that says, look, we don't have any formal agreements. Essentially, we can try to work something out. You can have what you had. We can have what we had. Left the ball's in your court, call me. What happens at that point? We don't get a contract coming back prepared with any essential terms, with any material terms. We get a letter that's ghostwritten by Cohen's lawyers. That's a contract by gotcha that they want to sit on at some point later on in the process, and frankly, that's why we're here today, where they pull it out and said, oh, we got a contract because we sent you this letter with all of these terms in it and you didn't respond to it. Judge McCuskey found, and he found correctly as a matter of fact, that these parties never intended to enter into a contract at that time frame. This is not a statute of frauds case because there never was a contract. And that's exactly what Judge McCuskey said. There was never an intention to be bound by these parties to any terms. They continued to negotiate right up through the 11th hour, where on October 31st of 1997, the day before the contract was going to expire, we get two more faxes from Cohen's attorneys with new terms in it saying, let's sign these. And what Judge McCuskey said was, look, the cardinal rule of contract is you've got to intend to be bound. These parties never intended to be bound. Then he went on to say, let's assume, just for the sake of discussion, that this is a contract. If it is, you have no enforceable writings. And if you look at Exhibit 36, which the judge referred to earlier, never signed by an authorized agent of JMJ. In fact, that document was objected to. It was hearsay. It was never authenticated. Judge McCuskey never addressed the admissibility of it. He certainly didn't admit it, but it was hearsay. And what did the May 6th letter that came back said? You go ahead and try to work your deal, and we won't do anything. We'll sit back and watch and see if you work your deal out. And if you do, that's fine. If you don't, we're going to go ahead and look at some other alternatives.
Forgive me, Mr. Evan. Are we going to get to Dawson?
Well, Dawson is the letter of intent case. Parties can be bound by a letter of intent if they agree to be bound by a letter of intent. I contend that those two letters don't fall within the meaning of Dawson. They're not letters of intent. It's not, we're going to go ahead and be bound by this agreement. They both sign it. It's not what we have. We've got Mr. Morris replying, or we don't even know who's replying, actually, because the record is devoid of that fact. We have a letter that was proffered at the time of trial that's on JMJ letterhead. We don't know who signed it. And that letter says, look, we don't have any formal agreements. Maybe we can work something out. Left the ball's in your court. Get back to me. He sends back a letter. That is not the classic letter of intent that businessmen enter into, where they both sign the letter of intent and say, these are the essential terms, and then they put together their formalized contract, and a letter of intent can be used to enforce that kind of an agreement. We don't have that fact here. And if we look at the May 6th letter coming back from Mr. Cohen at Cohen Development, it says, you go ahead and do what you can, and see if you can extend the option. If you can't, we'll pursue some various fallback positions. That's where Judge McCuskey correctly says, to the extent that that's a promise, it's completely illusory because you never intend to do anything by way of anything other than non-recourse financing. You are not going to put up any money whatsoever on this deal. And what happens? Within a couple of months of that, Robert Cohen, the president of Cohen Development, sends a note to Les Cohen, who was working the deal, saying, Les, stop spending money on this. In September of 1997, Robert Cohen, the president of the company, goes to Jim Morris and said, Jim, we're going to do this deal by ourselves. I'm putting together a group of investors. To the extent that you can say that the May 6th letter is some kind of promise, that promise was breached. The moment that they went to JMJ and said, you're done, we're going to buy this by ourselves, that was it. If it was a promise, that promise was breached at that point, and we're back to square one. And what happens through the fall of 1997? Mr. Cohen is advised, and it's in his own notes, if the court looks at the, and I'm sure your staff has pulled this fact out. He notes that he was informed in September of 1997 that JMJ was unable to extend the option. JMJ said, there's no way we can extend it. And the ultimate deal was negotiation after negotiation after negotiation, and lo and behold, Cohen Development simply never exercised their option, and they wouldn't sign the agreement because they had a contract by gotcha that they relied on from day one back in May when they sent their letter that they were going to try to use today to form this contract. And that's why the note that Mr. Cohen put in his annotation says, and I believe I've cited it in my brief, I don't know how my father's conversation with Mr. Morse is going to affect our cases against JMJ. And that's why Judge McCuskey found, rightfully, as a matter of fact, that there was never an intention to be bound. Thank you.
Right, counsel. You've got 1 minute, sir. All right. Thank you. We will proceed to case number 5. Thank both of you for your help.